Today on Misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel.
Sarma was the brand, the raw vegan queen.
It was such a great environment to work in. If none of this had ever happened, we'd probably still be working there.
Bad Vegan came out, and I remember thinking, to watch the documentary and see how different the story was from the headlines, I was like, that's fascinating.
One of the interesting things that happened on the other side of Bad Vegan is...
What happened to Mr. Fox?
Elizabeth is basically hunting him down, and to her credit, goes to great lengths to find him.
After what happened in Bad Vegan, what in real time happened to that location?
When I was back there at one point, looked in my eyes and said, the universe held that space for you, and you're meant to come back.
What was Rikers like?
It was very surreal because I was still in a state of shock.
As I read at the end of your book, it sounds like you're doing a new docuseries.
Yeah, there is a new docuseries. It will tell the story of how did this happen to me.
A little over a year ago, I had Sarma Melangalis on the show for one of the most talked about episodes we've ever done. We unpacked Bad Vegan, the Netflix docuseries that told her story, but didn't exactly tell it right. We talked about Shane Fox, psychological manipulation, and how the truth is often far messier and far more human than the headline version we get online. Last week, I replayed that interview as part of our summer series, and this week, I'm back with Sarma, live in New York, for something completely different, because Sarma just published her very first book. And it's not just any book, it's the biggest book I've ever seen, and genuinely one of the best books I've ever read. It's honest, layered, emotional, funny, filled with anxiety, raw, and really smart. She takes us behind the scenes of her life in a way no article or doc ever could. And reading it, you realize just how deeply misunderstood she's been, not just as a woman or a business owner or someone in a scandal, but as a person. In this conversation, we talk about writing the book, reclaiming the narrative, and how she sees herself now and what's next. If you think you know her story, you don't. Here's my in-person interview with the one and only Sarma.
It's so good to see you again.
It's really good to see you.
I literally flew here for you. Like, I made a whole trip around seeing you.
I'm really flattered. And I love that because I think podcasts are so much better in person.
Totally.
It's just a bit of, I don't know, it feels there's a better energy.
Well, also, I felt like you deserved it because you were so good to me 2 years ago or whenever it was and I spoke to you last, like, you came and trusted me and we had this amazing like 2 hour conversation and you like opened up to me so much. And
I just re-listened to it like on one time, you know, almost 2x speed before I came here because I realized I hadn't listened to it in a while. And I love that podcast.
Yeah.
I loved it.
I thought I've listened to it a couple times myself over the last however long it's been. I thought it was great. I thought you know, I was such a fan. I'll never forget where I was. I was in some dingy apartment that I lived in, having a very difficult time. And I watched it. And it was during, I guess, COVID or the end of COVID a little bit. When did that come out?
It came out after COVID.
Okay.
So COVID was 2020 is when it started and it Bad Vegan came out in 2022.
Right. So it was still the time when no one went to movies. Like Netflix was the thing. Like
yeah.
You watched everything and you were binging everything.
Yeah.
And Bad Vegan came out and I remember thinking, oh, I kind of remember this story because I was living in New York and I wasn't a vegan, but I knew exactly where the restaurant was. I knew a lot of the people that went there and I had heard about it. And I just remember seeing the headlines and just being like, oh, I wonder what happened there. That sucks, you know? And then to watch the documentary and see how different the story was in the documentary from the headlines, I was like, that's fascinating. And a lot of the stuff you said, I remember it to this day, you were talking about, and I'm paraphrasing, so forgive me if I get it wrong, but how you put on this persona in your restaurant for people and everyone came to see you. But that really wasn't who you were. And you were like somewhat of a recluse, and you would go home and you would be with Leon, and that's where you felt most comfortable. And you loved working and you loved being there, but it was like hard for you to put on this air of who you really were not. But you were seen as this very energetic, outgoing celebrity. And inside, you know, you were much, you felt much more secure alone.
Yeah, I think it wasn't so much that I was sort of pretending to be someone I wasn't. It's just that, and I understand much more now about myself and my wiring, that just that amount of being kind of social and talking to guests and putting myself out there is something that is a lot more draining for me than it would be for most people.
Right.
And makes me feel kind of uncomfortable. So yeah, I mean, I'm sort of a classic introvert.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, one of the interesting things that happened on the other side of Bad Vegan is, I was getting bombarded with all kinds of, you know, incoming DMs and comments and messages, but sprinkled in there was an enormous number of people, usually women, usually around my age, or, you know, give or take 10 years, saying, have you ever been diagnosed for autism or Asperger's? I mean, I heard that a lot, so much so that I ended up going for one of those very extensive evaluations and, got a diagnosis.
No way.
Yeah, which explains.
What did they say?
A lot for me. I mean, I wasn't really surprised because by that time I had done a lot of research into it. But it helps explain. So basically, it used to be called Asperger's. Now they renamed it Autism 1 because there's some controversy over the Asperger's dude that it was named after.
Okay.
But it helps explain certain things about sort of why I get very drained. The way it manifests in females is very different in males. Mm. So my last boyfriend, I think, I don't know if you care if I said, but I think he certainly would, if he was diagnosed, he would get that diagnosis as well. And the thing is, I used to joke around about how if I was like on a dating app, I would be like the, you know, single female seeks dude on the spectrum, because I like people who have those characteristics and I feel very comfortable. And it never occurred to me that I would get that diagnosis as well.
What are the characteristics?
With men, so there's very much a straightforwardness that sometimes is like an awkward bluntness, but very straightforward. So, they're not going to be sort of crafty. They're not going to pretend to be somebody they're not. There's a very much like what you see is what you get. And also that sort of shared tendency that I have where you sort of need a lot of alone time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just,
I think I have all these. So this is making me feel, I'm so interested in what you're saying. And yeah. Is there any negative to it though? I mean, or just understanding why you're like that was helpful for you?
Getting the diagnosis was definitely helpful, because I think it also explained a lot about how I felt when I was younger.
Mm.
And it made me feel a little sad, because I think if it was something that was discussed back then as much as it is now, and something that I knew and people were aware of, it would be a little bit different. I wouldn't have sort of my whole childhood or adolescence wondered what was wrong with me and felt like there was something wrong with me because I didn't want to do things most people wanted to do. And I would come back from school and just be drained. I mean, similarly to how I was at the restaurant, I would come back and just be exhausted.
Right.
And even just school, I would come home and just sit and zone out and watch, you know, Oprah and MTV. And I couldn't imagine how people could do sports and things like that. But I think, you know, especially for women with this diagnosis, what is highly correlated with having this diagnosis, sadly, is being targeted for abuse.
Right.
Because there's sort of a, you know, it's like you can kind of miss, we could have a tendency to misread people and not kind of understand their true intentions. So it's a bit like a sort of having a sort of a gullibility.
Mm.
and just kind of assuming that everybody else is being straight with you. So there's something about it that makes it much more likely for you to be targeted.
Right. And now that you've learned that this is what you have, or these are your traits, does it explain to you how to maybe pick men better, get into relationships, even friendships better, now that you have this, you know, now that you have this label, I guess it would say?
Yeah, it's helped. I mean, I've been very, the last couple of years have been like not interested in dating at mm-hmm. all whatsoever, like just no, zero interest.
So you're not on Bumble?
No.
Okay.
Oh God, no. No. But even with friendships, I've always had a bit of a challenging time, even with female friendships, because I'm not, like, I'm just not that person that wants to go to every party, get together. It, all of it drains me.
Yeah.
And when I'm going through a lot of challenges otherwise, I'm just not, you know, I'm that friend where if you need something, if you're having a crisis, if you need something, if you need advice, I will do it. I will be there. I will show up. But I'm not going to want to just hang out all the time.
Right.
And that's hard for some people to understand. And it has made that really challenging for me, because I also just kind of constantly, I don't want to disappoint people.
Right.
So I feel bad.
Well, I think people also assume that if they don't understand that quality or that about you, they assume that you're making other plans. I mean,
yeah.
By the way, I possess all those things that you say. I don't like going out, even though I worked at a nightclub and I, you know, I'm yeah. doing this kind of thing all day long. This kind of stuff drains me. And I can't even believe I found someone to marry me that doesn't care, that I don't want to go out to dinner every night. That is very stressful for me, because people think they know me, or I wonder, you know, if people are going to talk about the way I look if I don't get all decked out, or just stupid things like that. I'd rather be home with my dogs every night of the week, and I have to force myself to like get out of my house and do
it's
and
also
do
just
something.
Like a sensory overload, because I realized I almost wish that it would become more normalized for people to kind of go to each other's homes.
Yeah,
because lately I've had sometimes like people want to get together or meet up, and even people I you know, where it seems a little bit awkward to invite them into your home, but more and more I've had people just come by my place. You know, I can shut the door to my bedroom and I have an office, and that's so much more comfortable. And I think part of that is just that isn't nearly as draining. And I think because there's not all that sort of outside stimulus where like there's all these other people around.
Yeah.
That's definitely more relaxing. Or even going to somebody else's home is much more relaxing than being out at a busy restaurant and having to navigate like where are we going to sit and all of that.
No, I get it. All right. Let's get right into your book, because obviously last time you were here, we talked for over 2 hours about the situation. And I guess we can recap it a little bit, and you recap it all in your book. By the way, did you write this yourself?
Oh, yeah.
This is like 650 pages, right? How many pages?
Yeah. I mean, my original draft was 300,000 words. That book is 200,000 words. And so I had to cut a lot. I cut and cut and cut and cut. There's so much stuff I didn't want to cut, but I just kind of had to keep shading.
Did you have an editor that helped
more
you
and more.
Do all that?
Yeah. Like with traditional publishing, I did have an editor who helped at the end, kind of helped me. I mean, I rearranged it a lot so many times, because it jumps back and forth in time. And fortunately, I love the feedback that I get from people, because people keep telling me, the thing I hear most often is people say they can't put it down, and that it flows. So it's not like a big, it's almost just like a couple of books in one versus a big weighty book.
Right. So I just want to say something for people that can actually see, like, look at how thick this book is. Okay. This is not your normal book. And the writing is really tiny. Okay. I needed my glasses to read this. I just picked apart. So I got this book probably from maybe Amazon or something like a week and a half ago, knowing I was going to see you. I knew I would never be able to finish it. So I just picked apart in the middle. I opened it up, and as you saw, I was in the Bahamas last week, and I just started it. I literally couldn't put it down. I'm obsessed with my Netflix shows and my series and whatever. Since I started your book, I finished it. Since I started your book, I didn't watch TV.
You finished the book?
Yeah, I finished it.
Oh, amazing.
And I didn't get to read the first half, because I started in the middle thinking, oh, I'll just like skip around to see, because a lot of it I know from talking about. I now need to go back and read the first half, because I got through this entire thing. And I couldn't put it down. And I was like getting up at 5 a.m. to read more. And like, it is, Sarma, I'm not just telling you this. It is so well written and it's so good. And you should write more books. Because this was like amazing.
I really do want to. I have another one outlined. I've just been trying to figure out what the title should be. But I do have a follow-up outlined because I have a lot more stories. Right. I have a lot more stories.
Well, and I want to hear about what happened with the new boyfriends. And you said, you talk at the end about it was a guy you met when you were living in Harlem and you ended up in court. I want to hear some crazy stories. Yeah.
Yeah, I have some crazy stories.
You could write a whole book on love, all your different, besides Mr. Fox, all the different people you've dated. What happened to the guy in Alaska? Like, remember?
Oh, well, we still talk all the time. Okay. He's in Alaska.
Did you end up ever going to Alaska?
I went before I moved back to New York. So I went to, a couple months after he moved there, I did go to Alaska for a few days.
Okay. I don't know if you remember, I'm from there.
Yes, I know. Yeah. I remember that. You told me that. And then he has come through New York twice. So once last summer and then once the summer before. So I've seen him then. So that's basically the only action I've had in the last number of years.
But you're not
I've basically been like a nun other than those,
oh my gosh,
those visits.
Well, it's funny you say that because for a long time I was a nun, kind of not by choice. I mean, I was on Bumble and everything and I couldn't find anyone. You know how everyone's like, oh, I can have sex with anybody in 2 seconds. It's all about finding the right one. That was not true. If I wanted to do that, although that's not even who I am,
yeah,
I can't just go have sex with somebody. I thought everyone was a loser on Bumble. I was like, how am I? And I never left my house either, kind of. So it's not like I was going to meet somebody at the bar. You know what I mean? But people have to read this book. It's so good. Even if they have no idea about the story or they know all about it, you still have so much
it's
more
very,
stuff.
It's very, very different than what's in Bad Vegan. And it's funny because I feel like the first part I feel like the second half is very grueling. Like it's very, I think it's hard for some people to read because it's, you're almost taken through what I went through.
Yeah,
in
I got
a way.
Anxious.
Yeah.
Reading all the text messages from him.
And yeah. There's a lot of dialogue. And the first half is definitely more fun because there's a lot more about my background. I mean, I bounce back and forth in time. So I'm kind of telling the Mr. Fox story and how I met him and how all of that happened. I also tell my whole background story about Matthew Kenny. In our last podcast, I sort of alluded to him by saying my ex, but it's Matthew.
Yeah.
And I tell my story about him. So he was sort of like my first rodeo with a certain type of person.
Right.
And that's something I've learned that, you know, if this happens to you, it's kind of very common for it to happen again.
Right.
So even though I'd been through a situation where I was financially drained by somebody, you know, you'd think, oh, I wouldn't make that mistake again. But in fact, you're just, for whatever reason, more likely to do it again until you really, really thoroughly understand it. So, the first half is where I also have my sort of early stories about what it was like in the Tennessee jail and then getting extradited to New York, flown to New York in handcuffs and my first time at Rikers and what that was like. So that's all in the first half of the book, along with my, you know, my background. And I tried to kind of not go too in-depth about my childhood and my history, but I just wanted to include enough of what felt like it was most relevant in terms of, you know, who I am and what would have made me extra vulnerable to somebody like Mr. Fox.
Right. Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Okay. Incidentally, I mean, I have this on my questions for later, but since you brought it up, what was Rikers like? I mean, everyone's talking about it because of Diddy, being there or whatever. But tell me about what it was like for you.
Well, there were in this book, I talk about right after, you know, I was arrested, I was brought to this small town jail in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. It was very surreal because I was still in a state of shock, and it was this slow, very slow thawing, being in sort of a weird dissociated state. And the Tennessee jail was, yeah, that was brutal. I was in a holding cell for 6 days, which you're not supposed to be in a holding cell that long. Mm-hmm. And before I was transferred to these dorms. But the holding cell was just, it was like a giant bathroom and then full of other women the whole time. And I write about that. And then I was flown with U.S. Marshals. That was crazy. I write about how I felt like Hannibal Lecter because they, going from, thankfully we were flown and I didn't have to go in like one of those buses.
Right.
Because it was really hot out. And, but in, at the airport at Tennessee, they put one of those leather belts on and then my handcuffs were attached to the leather belt.
Right.
So I'm walking through the airport with like my hands attached to this leather belt, feeling like Hannibal Lecter. And,
and was everyone looking at you like, why, I wonder what she did?
Yeah. I mean, they were pretty good. They had my sweatshirt wrapped around my hands.
Oh, okay.
Once we got into the airport. But yeah, I mean, I had this weird thought in my head. It was because we went from the Tennessee airport to Atlanta and then from Atlanta to New York. And so when we were in the Atlanta airport, which is a huge hub, I just had this weird thing in my head where I was like, oh, my God, what if it's like all these business travelers. I was like, what if I ran into somebody from like that I used to work with at Bear Stearns or Bain Capital or something?
Right.
What if I ran into somebody from my previous life?
And they come running up, hey, Sarma, how's it going?
Expecting to give me a hug. And I'm like, yes, sorry. I probably looked like a crazy person because my hair, I'd been in the Tennessee jail for, I think I was there for 10 days or 2 weeks. So my hair was all crazy and frizzy and anyway, it was really weird. And then going to Rikers. Yeah, that was definitely quite an experience. So I write about that in this book. And then what I didn't get to write about, which I would include in the second book, is when I had to go back to do 4 months there. And that I have so many stories from that.
But did they treat you, first of all, what is it like? Everyone says it's the worst place on earth. What does it smell like? What are the hours like? Is it just a big dorm? How did they treat you?
I was in a dorm of, there's 50 beds, so there's up to 50 women in there. I was never in a cell, in a one or two person cell. So both times when I was there initially, and then I was out on bail for a year, and then I went back. Mm-hmm. So I was always in the dorms. And I think it's not as bad as it had. I think I got lucky in that it wasn't as bad as it had been a while ago, because I think they had just cracked down and they put in a lot more security cameras.
Okay.
And then I think it got really bad. Thankfully, you know, I was long gone before COVID happened, and I just can't even imagine what it was like then.
Yeah.
Because you're really close to people. The beds are 3 feet apart.
Right.
It's kind of, it's also kind of surreal being there. And there's a lot to observe in terms of human nature and watching other people and how they interact. You definitely get a firsthand look at how completely messed up the bail system is. I was lucky. I got on bail. Then I came back. But a lot of people are there locked up. They're not convicted yet. They just were arrested. They might have been falsely arrested.
Right.
And if they don't have the money for bail, which in some cases is not that much,
right,
just because they don't have the money, they're stuck there. And then what happens? Who's taking care of their kids? Then they lose their job, their apartment, they're trapped. They have no ability to get out over just, you know, not that much money in some cases. Like how, in what world is that remotely fair? It's horrible. And,
what do you do all day? I mean, do they give you cards? Like, do you just sit around? Do you have books?
When I was there for my longer stay, mm-hmm. I was very lucky in that people mailed me books. So I was mailed. I got a ton of mail, which was amazing. And I got
just from people who had seen
people who knew that I was there.
Okay.
And you know, people who followed my Instagram. I think I left a post on Instagram before I went to jail that basically said, I'll be away for a while. And so people sent me over 250 books.
No way.
So I had my choice of books to read.
And they let you have all these, or they keep them in a room? And
They didn't let me have all the books, but I became friendly with the male people once they realized I'm not an asshole. Yeah. You know, you kind of got to, there's sort of this assumption that everybody's an asshole mm-hmm. until they figure out that you're not. And so I was very, very polite and deferential. And, you know, a lot of times when I'm in the mail area where you get your mail, if I'd already read the book or if I didn't want it or something, they would just keep it.
Right.
And then I became sort of almost like a librarian where people would come to my little area and would borrow books for me to read. Right. So,
and for the most part, were the women friendly to you?
It was a mixed bag. But, you know, I think I was able to handle myself pretty well. You know, there are times where people would try to start fights, mm-hmm. but I was kind of very zen about it. So it was like, there was no reason for somebody to start a fight with. They would still try sometimes, but it's like I just wouldn't react.
Right.
And if you're not reacting, there's not really anything they can do.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. So again, going back to your book, the name, The Girl with the Duck Tattoo, why'd you pick that name?
It's the name started almost like a bit of a joke. I don't remember how it came about, but of course there's that book, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which mm-hmm. became a film. And, mm-hmm. And I love that book. Mm-hmm. So the title sort of started as a joke, and then it just kind of stuck. And I couldn't think of a better one. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, the tattoo is very meaningful to me and the whole brand and everything that I've been doing. And so it just, the title fit.
Explain your brand with the duck.
So the duck tattoo I got after I had sorted out the One Lucky Duck brand. Mm-hmm. So One Lucky Duck was the more accessible brand name that we used for cookies and snacks and things. So I had opened the restaurant Pure Food and Wine with this guy, Matthew, mm-hmm. in 2004. And then Matthew and I split up. And meanwhile, we were selling, I developed a product line and we were selling these really, really good raw vegan snacks and cookies and things. We were selling it at Whole Foods and more stores. And had an e-commerce site. And so when I was starting the e-commerce site, I needed a name for it. And One Lucky Duck was the name. And then once the logo was designed, I went and got the tattoo. It's my one and only tattoo. And it just was, you know, so I branded myself with the brand. Mm-hmm. And I felt really, really strongly at the time that, you know, I sort of quietly, I had this sense that this is very meaningful and that this is going to be a big brand and it's going to be important, you know, because for me, it's not about trying to turn everybody vegan at all. Mm-hmm. It's more about, you know, wanting to help everybody shift to eating more naturally and more healthfully and ideally much, you know, more plants
right.
and fruits and vegetables and whatnot. And so it's really, really meaningful to me. And I felt like it was going to be really big. So the duck has always been a big deal for me.
Right. When you were writing this book, why did you write it? What did you feel had not been told in Bad Vegan?
Well, I'd started writing it before Bad Vegan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd probably written most of a very rough draft, or at least the first 2/3 of it. So either way, I was going to write the book. I always knew I was going to write the book.
Okay.
But I think, you know, it took a really long time. And I think it needed to take a really long time because I needed to kind of really be able to process what happened and be able to understand and analyze and reflect. So I think it just needed to take a long time to write it.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to be as useful as possible. So, I think that it is, but it's a big story and
yeah.
there's a lot that happens. And I was dealing with, thankfully I had recovered a lot of our communications, not all of them, by any stretch, but enough of them that I could piece together a lot of what happened. And I think we talked about this in the last podcast, but it's hard to write about something when you, for a lot of that time, were very dissociated and don't remember.
Yeah.
So it took a long time to go through and sort of put it together. And,
right.
And then also to include enough analysis that's meaningful and useful. You know, I want it to be something that's really useful for people.
Yeah. So in doing the docuseries, you had mentioned you gave a lot of this stuff, documents, emails, whatever it was, to the people working on the film. Do you feel like they didn't get it? They didn't use it? Like, the takeaway from Bad Vegan was that people didn't understand, you know, all of a sudden they're following this journey for four episodes or whatever it was. And then it was like, well, wait, was she in on it? Is she, how does someone so smart and beautiful get wrapped up with this? Like, you kind of couldn't figure it out, which, by the way, is great filmmaking, right? Because everyone was talking about it. But obviously it wasn't great for you, because at the end they were like, oh my God, is this girl a criminal? Is she crazy? What was the real story? And you feel like after watching this whole thing and being invested, you didn't really know.
Yeah. Yeah. People were really angry about the end, or they just thought that I was in on it, which was really, really painful for me.
Right.
It was a massive betrayal by the filmmakers. Yeah. And I think the director, Chris Smith, I think there was sort of some evil genius in there where, he crafted something where by what he excluded, you know, he sort of crafted in a way where if you were somebody who'd been manipulated and you'd been through something similar, you're going to be very sympathetic and you're going to understand what happened. If you have never been manipulated or you're like half on your phone, there was enough in there that the way he edited it and to kind of create doubt. So you could kind of watch it and come away with two totally different conclusions.
Sure.
And then, you know, in multiple places, he moved my words around. Mm-hmm. And when we did the last podcast here, I wasn't even aware at that time that they moved my words around in the call and the end too. So not only was that call at the end that kind of makes everybody think that I'm laughing with this man who destroyed my life and that I'm sort of joking around with him, but they moved my words around. So it makes it seem like, you know, it makes it seem like I'm kind of laughing with him and we're sort of reflecting on how like we should have gotten away with it or something.
Right.
And the way my words, and I know my words were moved around because I'm the one who made that recording. I have the original audio. Mm-hmm. And what he says on that phone call and the way I respond was completely the opposite from the way they show me responding, because they pulled the audio from somewhere else. You know, so it's like as if I said yes somewhere else and I said no, but then they pulled the yes and replaced the no.
Right.
And I don't know, that just seems really fucked up.
Right. Well, it's fucked up for you as a person who has to deal with it. For them, it made the story what it was, right? Which was this creative genius kind of like, oh my God, what an amazing show. This girl is crazy, you know, as opposed to like having a soft ending.
Right. But it was really damaging. I mean, really, really damaging. And I still to this day, you know, hear about it, especially, you know, talking to investors or secondhand, somebody will say, yeah, well, they watched Bad Vegan and like they don't, yeah, no, people just, even if they don't think I'm necessarily a criminal, they sort of come away going,
they don't trust you.
Right.
The credibility was shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you've got to work all that time. I mean, that must be really hard too, because even as you write through the book, I mean, knowing you now, it's funny to read that stuff and see how Mr. Fox will come, is asking for money, and you're like, no, fuck you, fuck you. And then you're like, and the next day I gave him 50,000. And then the next day, 60,000, 10,000. And it's just like, I feel so frustrated as someone that knows you, but I get it, you know, and I get that. And, but I guess the question that people would ask, knowing you or not, is, you know, now looking back, all the work that you've done, what would you say to people that are asking you, and I'm sure it frustrates you, but how could you have not seen through it? Why did you keep doing it? Even as you were struggling to pay these bills, you were feeling guilty, your credibility was being shot. How did you keep giving in to him?
Well, I think that's part of why the book had to be as long as it is, because you sort of go through that journey with me where it's this – sort of gradual entrapment where you kind of end up having no choice but to keep going. And then you end up in a place where you're getting more and more dissociated from reality.
Yeah.
And you just kind of feel like you have no choice but to keep going. And I even point that out in the book that, you know, a friend of mine who had read some early drafts said, you know, why, you know, you're including all this talk where you're talking back to him and you're yelling at him and calling him a, you know, a liar.
And,
yeah, I was calling him all kinds of names. I mean, a lot of that, I think, provides a little bit of comic relief.
Yeah.
I mean, people keep telling me that they're stressed out reading it, but then they like laugh out loud
yeah.
because of some, you know, funny comeback yeah. that I throw at him. Yeah, I mean, that's why the book is so long, is I sort of try to take you through it to help people understand that you just get completely trapped. And there's no way out. And so it's almost like there's no alternative.
Can you explain to people what coercive control is?
I mean, coercive control is, you know, it's most common in sort of, you know, intimate relationships, but it's just a series of tactics that that people can use to end up controlling somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, including gaslighting and you know, sort of by definition, you don't really realize it's happening.
Right, right. And it's interesting reading, especially the last half, about the dissociation that you talk about, because you can read it in there. Because, you know, you go to Rome and you're like, I don't really know what I'm going to do here. Or you go to Miami and you see that you're there for quite a while. And I know your love for your dog. And I know you have a family. And I know you have this business. So for you to have gone to those places and be able to turn off your phone and just completely disassociate and find something to do all day, not really knowing what you're there for, when you're a person that seems driven by a purpose, you know,
yeah.
You've got to be in such a state, and the fact that you don't remember, I mean, all these things I really identify with, but it's like, I think that people that have not gone through that or to that extent really don't know what that's like and how you get to a place like that. So I guess, can you explain to people that are listening what that dissociation is like and how days or weeks can go on where the things that you live for and is your biggest love and purpose, you just completely compartmentalize and it's gone. Like you don't focus
yeah.
on that.
Yeah.
Anymore.
I think it's really hard for people to understand what dissociation would be like because, mm-hmm. you know, it's like your thinking and your emotions kind of get detached. And so you're able to sort of function like a normal human being, but you're not all there.
Yeah.
And something has kind of broken. And it happens, you know, it can happen in a sort of an isolated moment with under extreme stress, but it can also happen when you're under prolonged stress and fear.
Right.
And fear especially is something that makes people dissociate. So, you know, again, it was like this gradual process, but the more afraid I got and the more dire the circumstances got, you know, the more I dissociated. It's a coping mechanism.
Right.
And so, you know, that's why it astonishes me too, that I could be without Leon for stretches of time
yeah.
And away from the business and just, again, it's hard to describe, but it's like, you're just not there.
Right. A question I had, because I know you left Leon with your parents a couple times.
With my mom.
Yeah, with your mom. But when you left Leon with him, with Mr. Fox, did you feel like he was taking care of Leon well? I mean, did he love Leon?
Well, I wouldn't say I can't comment on his ability to feel anything. You know what I mean? Yeah. I would imagine he's a sociopath and mm-hmm. he doesn't really feel things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he... You know, heartbreakingly, Leon seemed to really like him.
Okay.
You know, and I mean, Leon really liked everybody. So he did seem to take care of Leon well. I mean, I never once saw him. A couple of times we would argue because I would insist that, like, no, Leon needs to go out to pee. And he mm-hmm. would say, no, he's fine. And I'm like, no, I think he needs to go out to pee. So mm-hmm. that sort of rubbed me wrong a couple of times. But otherwise, it seemed like he always took care of him.
Yeah. Because I know that was just a question I had, because I noticed there were times when you would leave Leon with him and I thought, oh gosh, I just wonder if he ever walked him. I mean, I read the part where you said you found that Snapple bottle or whatever it was, and he had peed in
it because
he didn't even want to get out of bed. And what a lazy fuck this guy is.
Yeah.
And it's like, did he really get up to walk the dog, or he just let Leon pee on the floor and he would just pick it up later, you know? And it made me, because we're dog lovers, so it just makes me so anxious.
It's heartbreaking. I mean, it really, really is heartbreaking to think that, you know, I mean, maybe he has some affection for animals. I mean, I know, you know, Matthew had an affection for cats. Mm-hmm. You know, Mr. Fox, his mother had dogs. They had dogs in the house. Mm-hmm. Even where he ended up later on, I saw on his social media, he was with a dog. So, you know, I don't think I can't imagine that he was cruel to Leon.
Right.
But probably there were times where, like, Leon had to pee and you know, he wasn't taking him out as soon as he could have.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to think about that.
Leon is like a co-star in your book and in your life in general. How, you know, explain to people that don't really know your relationship how important that dog was to you.
I mean, the way that I got him felt like, for lack of a better word, destined. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd never experienced something like that before where you just feel like I had to get this dog.
Right.
And I think I talked about it in the last podcast, but I just felt like there was a force beyond me that pulled me to get this dog.
Right.
So, I felt
very... And at first you had wanted him for Alec Baldwin, right?
Yeah. So I was trying to convince Alec Baldwin to get a dog. And, you know, I was like, oh my God, this is the dog. There's something about this dog. And he wasn't interested in getting a rescue dog, especially not, you know, a big old rescue pit bull.
Right.
And I just got weirdly obsessed with this dog and then ended up getting him myself, which at the time seemed totally nuts because I was busy. I was exhausted. You know, I had my office was in my apartment, so he was going to be, you know, around with all of these people and inventory and the business. And how was I going to have time to take care of him? But it was like I didn't have a choice. I just had to get him.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, and I think that he I almost feel like he kind of kept me grounded in a way where I just remember so many times where I would look into his eyes and think, you know, I would tell him it's going to be okay, almost as if I was reassuring myself.
Yeah.
You know, I would just look into his eyes and that would make me feel better throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Leon, since we met, has passed away. I'm so sorry for your loss. Do you think you'll ever get another dog?
I'm sure I will, but it will be a while. And, you know, who knows? Maybe I'll get it. I mean, who knows? Maybe I'll – I don't know. It'll happen at some point, and maybe it'll happen in a similar way where it kind of happens to me as opposed to me sort of making a trip to go look for a dog.
Sure.
But I think right now my hands are full and you know, you need a lot of resources to be able to take care of a dog, especially in the city, because you can't just kind of open the back door and let them run out into the yard. You have to go out and walk them multiple times a day and, you know, and the vet and food. And I'm not really in a place where I'm ready to do that yet.
Right.
But, I mean, one day I want to, you know, if I was super successful again, I'd want to have like the house upstate with, you know, all the dogs.
Right. With all the dogs you can help. I know. Me too. That's like my dream. Okay. You've been through a lot. And I don't want to rehash the whole thing we did in the podcast. Everyone can go back and listen to that. Everyone can read the book, frankly, is what they can do. But at what point did the healing start to happen for you? Because I feel like you were so deep in a lot of stuff for a really long time. At what point did you start to feel like, okay, now I can come out of this. Now I can find my way out?
It was a really gradual process, but one thing I think is important for people to know, especially if they've been through anything like this, is I think the healing doesn't start for a while because I know I was definitely still in that sort of state of shock for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And then I think the whole bad vegan thing did not help. I think that sort of threw me back into a, you know, like that sort of state of PTSD and being traumatized and kind of frozen and coping with what's right in front of you. So I think it takes a while, and I think it also requires a lot of alone time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's part of why I haven't been interested in relationships or anything like that, because I really need my alone time. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't have kids. You know, I don't have a roommate or anything like that. So I'm lucky that I get a lot of time to myself, because you need that quiet time to really like decompress and to let the feelings come up. And I think writing the book and even editing it, you know, because it took a lot of rounds of going through it myself and reading it over and over again. And you know, as I said, I had to shorten it a lot, even to get it to what's still a very long, long book.
But it reads very fast, by the way.
It does. And I'm so gratified, because a lot of people who told me they don't read books anymore because they just kind of have a hard time paying attention have told me that they found it. They were able to read it. And I think it helps. The chapters are short and it reads in a very conversational way. So it's sort of like I'm telling you a story.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it moves fast. But for me, writing the book, I think, is what allowed me to process it. So I think people who've been through anything, even if you don't intend to publish it, I think it's important to kind of write it all out so that it's really clear in your own head. And then writing it out is sort of what allows you to put it in the past.
Yeah.
I think if I'd never written the book, it would still like live inside of me in a way. And so writing the book is what allowed me to get it out of me and also to really reflect on sort of what is it about me that allowed this to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. In your writing, you do take responsibility for all the things that happen while you explain what happened. Right. So I think, you know, how do you hold both truths that you know what I mean? How would you say that?
Yeah. I think in the introduction, I write about that exactly, where I say, I think I say something like, please allow me to tell the story without really knowing how to refer to, was it something that happened to me? Is it something that I allowed to happen?
Right. You know, maybe true can be both. Both can be true at the same time, you know, and I think it takes a long time.
I mean, I think it's clear that it's, you know, the result of everything that happened is clearly something that I never in a million billion years would have ever intended. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is. It's very hard to talk about. And I even throughout the book, I sort of, you know, very careful about. Even now, I mean, the whole, you know, there's so much around that word victim. Mm-hmm. And people are very quick to accuse somebody of, oh, you're making yourself out to be the victim. It's like, okay, but what if I was?
Yeah.
And then at the same time, recognizing that, yeah, I have agency. I wasn't locked in a room. You know, I could have run away.
Right.
But, you know, it's like people that get into cults or a lot of abusive situations, you know, even with the whole P. Diddy thing, people don't understand why did Cassie, right? Like, you know, why did she go back to him? Why did she stay? And people, if they've never been in it before, they don't understand the power of fear and the power that these people can have over us without us realizing that they have so much power.
Right. And I don't think a lot of people have come into contact with somebody like Mr. Fox before.
Right. No, there's a very deep, deep darkness there. Mm-hmm. Somebody said to me, I mean, I get so many comments lately, which I love. People DM me about, you know, certain chapters or what they're reading or what they found funny or what resonated. But somebody recently said to me, you know, like you looked a demon in the eyes. And that's kind of how it feels in retrospect, is that, you know, I was up close with a certain kind of darkness that it's just very, very creepy.
Yeah. For me, the most frustrating part, if it's okay for me to tell
you. Yeah, of course.
When I was reading it, you lose everything.
Yeah.
And then you somehow find your way to reopen this place.
Yeah.
To get your staff to trust you, to get Jeffrey, I guess, to trust you, to believe in you. And you are able to reopen the restaurant. And then he comes back and he takes it all again and ruins it all again and takes you away from it. And it was so frustrating. And I guess they talk about it in Bad Vegan too, right? Because I recall something in there where feeling like we see in this episode, oh, she's getting it back. And then it all goes to shit again. And to me, that's the most frustrating, to see how devastating that must have been. I mean, it must have been excruciating to ruin the relationship with this woman, Nadia. Is that what her name was?
There were some names in the book that I changed, but
whoever
just because I just want to be, I wanted to err on the side of protecting anybody's privacy, but yeah, I call her
right.
Nadia.
Okay, so the woman, better known as Nadia, to see how she trusted you and then all that stuff happened. First of all, just business-wise, how did you always get people to give you money? That's a huge strength.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy because it's also like the last thing that I want to do. Like, I'm one of those people right. where, you know, I'm the classic, I don't want to ask for anything.
Right.
Like, I will, you know, I'd be that person like lugging a couch down the sidewalk right. by myself because I don't want to ask anybody to help me.
Right.
You know, I remember once in college, I cried. I lived in a, this is going to sound weird, but I lived in a fraternity house one summer because I ended up getting a dual degree. So I stayed and I lived in this house with these friends and I couldn't get my air conditioner in the window. And I remember crying because I didn't want to go downstairs and just ask somebody to help me. Like it's so, that's how much I don't want to ask people for stuff. And so asking for money is like, oh.
But you could go into fundraising because you're so amazing with getting people to believe in you and give you money. I mean, don't you think that's a pretty specific skill that a lot of people don't have?
I don't think I have a skill in terms of fundraising. I think what I have is so much belief in that concept.
Yeah.
That's what people see. You know, you hear about when you listen to like podcasts with these big investors and you always hear them say, the really big successful investors, that they'll look at the numbers, but they don't really care about the numbers. It's all about the person, their passion,
right.
and just a sense of kind of belief in that person
right.
and their passion for the project or whatnot. So I definitely had that. I still have that.
Right.
So I think that's what would sort of get people to want to put money in. And also I think it's that restaurant and the brand and the potential and what was built there and how beloved it was. And even so there are people who'd been there and experienced it, but I think even just from reading about it or seeing some of the footage in Bad Vegan or people can tell that it was a really, really special, beloved place.
Yeah.
And that it really should exist again.
So after the fact, after we see what happened in Bad Vegan, what in real time happened to that location? It remained unoccupied, correct?
Yeah.
Is it still there and still unoccupied?
Oh, it's funny because I'm actually writing about everything that happened on my Substack. I only recently joined Substack, but because people are asking me sort of what's happened there. And, you know, as with a lot of things, it's sort of a long and complicated story. So I started to write about it. I mean, I was going to reopen in the same location and perhaps it will happen.
But right now it's still there as is unoccupied.
It's still there. Okay. Yeah.
And nothing ever went in after it closed?
No, they had done some sort of pop-up events there, but nobody had permanently taken the space. And it is a really unique, beautiful space because, you know, I'd been asked in interviews, would you want to go back into the restaurant business? And I always said, only if it was the same restaurant in the same space, the same, you know, with whichever people were there before that are available now. And there are a lot. There are a lot of key people who would be available to come back. So.
And does Jeffrey own the building? Is that?
No.
Okay.
No, he had the lease.
He had the lease.
For a while, yeah.
Got it. Why do you think they never leased the space again?
I don't know. There's, you know, a lot of times I'm asked about other people's, you know, I don't know exactly why.
Yeah. It seems like such a prime space that just, it's almost like either kismet that it hasn't been leased again to anyone.
I mean, there is somebody involved in the space who, when I was back there at one point, you know, looked in my eyes and said, you know, the universe held that space for you and you're meant to come back. And, it feels that way.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about that. Can we? Like what I'm sure. Well, and as I read at the end of your book, it sounds like you're doing a new docuseries or documentary where there's a possibility of that. Is that correct?
Yeah. There is a new docuseries that I'm working on and it'll be very different from Bad Vegan in that, you know, it will tell the story of what happened, but, you know, even the film crew who worked on my interview, because I did a very lengthy interview, had seen Bad Vegan. And at the end of it, they were like, wow, that's really different than what was in Bad Vegan.
Right.
But importantly, we will have the analysis. So what I think was really frustrating for a lot of people and for me about Bad Vegan is that there wasn't anything. It was like, here, let's show you this train wreck, but not give you any important takeaways or not explain psychologically how does this happen,
right,
in a way that would really help people and also in a way that I think is most fascinating. I mean, I think the psychology side of it is fascinating.
Sure.
I'm fascinated with, like, how did this happen to me?
Right.
I don't understand, you know, what was this person doing to me that he got me to do the things that he got
me to do.
Because
I'm sure you read through some of these text messages, especially while writing the book, and be like, oh my God, how did I end up giving him this money the next day, even after these crazy exchanges? And I was so clear
bizarre.
I was not doing it, and then I do it.
And that's why I was so grateful that my journal was recovered, too.
Yeah.
That was really fascinating to read my own journal that I was writing during that time. And that really helped me understand and kind of see in my own handwriting just how far gone I was and very delusional about, like, this is all going to work out. And,
right. And is this a, somebody who came to you from, or a network, or how, can we hear any details? Like, when's it coming out? Like,
I don't know when it will come out. It's not done. Part of the, So the other part of the docuseries is sort of chronicling my move back to New York.
Got it.
And my intention to reopen the restaurant.
Sure.
And what happened there. And there's definitely quite a story there. Some of it was covered in an article that was in this thing called Grub Street, which is part of New York Magazine.
Okay.
Where they wrote about how I was moved back to New York to reopen the restaurant. And that
I think that's where you were at kind of when we first met.
Yes, exactly. Because I wasn't really able to talk about it.
Yeah. Can you talk about it a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, some of it's been reported. I think the people who brought me back here, it was very much on false pretenses. There was discussion of making a show, but I mean, it would be very clear that I would not want to work with the same people again. Basically, I would never do like a Bad Vegan 2, right?
Right.
I mean, after that kind of colossal betrayal, why would I go back and do that again? You know, I mean, Netflix really made fun of me. I don't really fault them at all. Not at all, but it's really the director who crafted what he did. And then based on what he did, it's not surprising that they would market it in the way that they did, where it kind of makes me look like I'm a criminal.
Right.
And the sort of billboards where I'm like eating a cash salad. And but it's really the director who made the film into what it was. So that's where I think the betrayal stemmed from and the other, the other producer on the project. So I think it's clear that I wouldn't sign up to do that again.
Oh, got it. Okay.
But I think they had the intention to do that and just figured, let's get her back here. Let's get her signed up. And then she'll have to kind of get on board and
part of
this.
That, though, was to film you while you opened up part two or whatever.
Yes.
And it was going to be, I'm assuming, like Good Vegan or whatever, because now you were opening up something and see if it really made it.
I think there was just this view that, you know, Bad Vegan had been so successful that either way, there's a ton of notoriety there.
Yeah.
And, you know, people will flock to the restaurant when it reopens, whatever they think of me, just because it was a big story.
Right.
And so I think there was this idea that let's capitalize on that and do a Bad Vegan 2 or whatever they would call it. And I know that there was a prearranged deal, like a per episode, that the filmmakers or whoever made it would get, you know, when Bad Vegan was sold to Netflix, because it was made by the director and the producer.
Okay.
They made it and then they sold it. So it was shopped around, you know, it was bid on by Apple. I forget who else, but also Netflix.
Yeah.
And I think Apple had offered more for it, but they ended up selling it to Netflix for a shit ton of money.
Okay.
Of which I did not participate.
Right.
So, you know, that just made the betrayal even.
Especially that you owe all these people.
Owe all these people money. And now it's going to be that much, like so much harder for me to recover because I'm up against people thinking I'm crazy. Maybe I had bad intentions, you know, questioning my judgment if I'd be laughing with this guy on the phone. So yeah, has made it a lot harder. And I was going to say it's made it a lot harder to recover. I haven't recovered at all.
Yeah.
You know, I've been through a lot the last couple of years, but I haven't recovered. And it's, it was really damaging. So to think that I would go, yeah, okay, let's do a round two. But I know that there was sort of a prearranged price that would be paid per episode if they did another series.
Right.
And I think that was the intention, but they didn't tell me that.
Right.
So once it kind of became clear that that was their intention, I was then threatened with either you get on board and do this show or there's no restaurant.
Right. And wasn't your apartment part of the whole deal? Like, weren't they helping you? They moved you here, right?
I was moved here. I was supposed to be paid a salary.
Right.
I wasn't. They never, you know, I was moved here based on an agreement where I was going to be paid a salary, you know, given health insurance and an apartment where, you know, my rent and utilities would be covered.
Sure.
So my rent was covered for a while. My utilities were never covered. Mm. I was never given health insurance and I was never given a salary. And every time I would bring it up, it was like, oh, yeah, we'll work that out. Or, oh, you know, the two people involved were like kept punting to the other person.
Sure.
And there was just no communication about what was going on. And there were all these delays. They're not paying me at all. And then later used it as leverage because they said, well, we'll pay you now all that stuff we were supposed to pay you if you get on board and do this show that you said you wouldn't do from the beginning.
Right.
You know, I was very clear from the beginning that I wouldn't do that. So and then they also stopped paying my rent. And that put me in a really bad
situation. So what happened? Did you have to move?
No. I mean, I didn't move because it's a lot. I mean, looking back now, I should have moved because just to save money. But I thought, okay, well.
It was near the restaurant, right?
I mean, I moved into this apartment because it's a block and a half away from the restaurant location. And
is that where you still are, by the way?
I'm still there.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's insane that I've somehow been able to stay there. You know, again, if I had known that it was going to take this long, I would have moved. It would have been the responsible thing to move to, I don't know, a tiny studio somewhere far away or even just leave the city again.
Yeah.
But what was I going to do other than work to go in there and reopen the restaurant on my own. I had a lot of people coming at me wanting to invest. But sometimes those people were not entirely forthright or, every situation is different. But I managed to stay in the apartment. Okay. And it's been rough. And now I'm only in more, you know, now I'm under piles of, on top of everything else, credit card debt.
Right. Oh, right.
Which is just really fun.
Do you still have, what is it called, restitution? Do you still have monies you have to pay?
I still have a lot of money that I will eventually have to pay. And it's painful that I haven't been able to.
But is it to people like your mom or things like that? Or is it like real money, like the government's like you have to pay X, Y, Z by this time?
There's nothing with like deadlines on it.
Okay.
But there's a lot of debt that I don't think anybody could force me to pay, but I feel a moral obligation that certainly if at any, you know, if I'm, and again, that's why, you know, that's why I've had to kind of swing for the fences, meaning, and not, it's not just because of the debt. Like if I won the lottery, I would still want to reopen the business. I would still want to, because I feel like it's supposed to exist again. I mean, the amount of messages that I get from people telling me, oh my God, you have to reopen that place. It was magical. That place was so special. Oh my God, it would be so amazing. I would fly there from, you know, Australia. Oh my God, I'd get on a plane and come there. And, you know, it was really beloved. And I think even now more than ever, there's a focus on eating really clean ingredients.
Yeah.
That I think there's even more of an opportunity now for people to want to eat the kind of food that we made because it was very clean. There's a lot of vegan junk food out there. Like I don't eat sort of vegan burgers and stuff like that.
I get like bars.
Yeah. I mean, I eat really clean and I eat from the Green Market and our ingredients are really, really clean.
So what's the status now? I mean, there's no one that in there. Why can't you just open it?
The status now is very is very up in the air, but it would require the right partners.
And you still haven't found those?
I still have not found the right partners. Yes. There's been a very fucked up situation with Jeffrey Chataro. And
meaning he betrayed you, you guys are no longer talking, or something else happened to him.
Yeah. I think that's why I kind of have to sort of methodically and factually tell the story of what happened. Because there's kind of no way to summarize it. And it, you know, I'm very wary of how people perceive me because, again, a lot of people are looking at me in the situation from the lens of having watched Bad Vegan, and I look a little bit, you know, cuckoo or whatnot. So I have to be very careful about how I present things. But, you know, one thing I'll just say is it is so incredibly reassuring to have the facts on my side where, you know, like the more – I mean, I felt this way about – this entire situation that I wrote in my book, where it's like the more information that comes out, if somebody subpoenaed all my emails and text messages, have at it. Like, you know, all of my communications with these people and with Jeffrey, and I have all of my communications with him. If it all came out, it's like the facts are on my side.
Right.
So,
so I take it that relationship is no longer good.
No. I mean, it did not help that he threatened me to, you know, if I didn't get on board with doing this other show,
okay,
there's
so
no
was
restaurant.
One of the other
that was not, you know, that was cruel.
Yeah.
And fucked up.
It's a shame because as you read this book, it is very clear that he's somebody you did not want to let down. He was like a father figure.
Yeah, he was.
Of sorts.
He was. It was a very complicated relationship because he could be a giant dick. And yet, you know, and yet he could be very kind to me sometimes and seem like he believed in me and wanted to help me. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I don't think that he's aware of his own cruelty.
Yeah.
You know, but I know that it's in my nature to constantly give people the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
And I did it again, even after he was kind of cruelly said to me, either you do this show or there's no restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, devastated. But over time, I thought, well, it was this third party that was involved who was really manipulative and mm-hmm. I think kind of was misrepresented things to him. And so I think Jeffrey didn't really understand what was going on. And so I gave him the benefit of the doubt. And then it's like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have done that.
Right. Do you think he must have seen Bad Vegan? Yes.
Well, he was in it.
Right. No, I know. Yeah. But
and he came across looking like a good dude, which he made sure of. I mean, he wouldn't have participated if he didn't. You know, it's rare that somebody gets to participate in a documentary and require that they're portrayed in a good light.
Right.
But
do you think he read your book?
Very. I sent him the draft. I know. I mean, reading a book of that length in a computer file is not easy to do. Since it's been published and it's available, you know, I have no idea if he's read it. I hope that he will, and maybe he'll understand more what happened because I think he never could understand what happened, and I think he felt in some deep way personally. I think he felt personally aggrieved. Like, almost like he was, you know, instead of looking at what happened, I think he felt sort of aggrieved, not understanding it, and almost felt like he was sort of the victim of the situation.
Well, yeah, and he probably thought he came in to save the day the last time around, too.
Right.
And maybe didn't see your side, so thought you let him down for the third time or the fourth time or whatever it was. Not seeing your side of how negatively the first docuseries impacted you. I mean,
just from an outsider's
perspective, I can understand why he was devastated that you wouldn't participate when he felt like, here I am giving you another chance again and you're screwing me. You know, maybe that's how he felt, even though you were the one that felt screwed. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of weird stuff happened. I mean, when they moved me back here, you know, Jeffrey had me start seeing a therapist who was his brother-in-law.
Oh, God.
Which, right? I mean, that's not normally, that's not normal and not okay, but very nice person. And I would completely understand. I think he wanted somebody that he knew to kind of give him a reassurance that,
this girl is sane.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Which he got. I mean, that therapist told him, you know, without, I think, betraying any confidence, said, you know, without a doubt, she was manipulated. And by the way, there's not a bad bone in her body.
Right.
That's what Jeffrey told me that he said that. There's not a bad bone in her body.
Yeah.
So it's like, all right, dude, remember he said that? Like,
yeah.
And yet, you know, he sort of aligned himself with this other producer and,
right.
And yeah, I mean, it's still hard for me to understand how he got to that point where he basically, you know, was, you know, how could you say that? Like knowing what that restaurant and what that project means to me and that my whole future is riding on it.
Sure.
And after everything that happened, that you would sort of dangle it in front of me and threaten to open it with somebody else right in front of me. I don't know. That's a cruelty. I don't understand.
I understand where you're coming from. So does he have access? The lease is not his, right? I mean, anyone could sign a new lease and you could bring that concept back? Or does someone actually own the concept? Like, how does that work?
No, I could bring the concept back.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you could get access to that lease. He has nothing to do. He can't stop you at this point.
I don't know. I mean, I'm it kind of scares me a little bit. He still scares me. There's something about Jeffrey that has always scared me. Mm-hmm.
Well, do you feel like you need him to make it work?
No. In fact, I just think I should
proceed without him.
I think there's no way in which we could ever. I never thought, based on the concept itself, you know, ideally you want somebody who believes really to their core about the concept and what it means for the world and why it's important. You know, so all along I want people who really understand the concept and they're not just kind of in it for this grab because there's notoriety
and
publicity. Of course not.
No.
Right. No.
I didn't know if he had become a vegan or something.
So. No. No. Okay. And it's not that somebody has to be a vegan, but you know,
no,
ideally they give a shit about, you know, the environment and, you know, maybe they can see that factory farming is not a good thing and destructive and cruel and, and that this is something that makes the world a better place. So, but yeah, I mean, after the sort of multiple betrayals and there's been more betrayal there that it's like, yeah, no. And I also just can't, you know, I just don't ever want to be involved with people who are not forthright, who are not telling you what's really going on.
Yeah.
You can't work with somebody like that. Like I err on the side of like being extremely open about everything. And I just feel like I don't see how you work in any kind of a business relationship where you're not that way.
So what's your goal? I mean, obviously your goal is to open this restaurant. You're clearly still in New York. Is something tying you here besides this dream of reopening the restaurant?
Well, I mean, you know, my apartment lease is, I have a guarantor. I'm not going to walk out on it.
Okay.
So I'm in a bit of a limbo state where I don't really know what's going to happen right now.
Okay.
And so.
But are you actively looking for people to invest in this restaurant so you could get it started again?
I would say yes. It's a little unclear what's going on right now in the space. And what's painful is that I previously had a really good relationship with the landlord there. And I think that they've been through a lot and that they believed in me and the concept. And I want to find a way to make it up to them. And I think that I could, you know, I think I could really, you know, make it up to them for what they've been through because they lost a lot when everything went awry and I wasn't, you know, the whole place shut down. So I think that there is a way that, you know, in the end, they could kind of not win. That's not the right word, but that I could make it up to them and they could sort of benefit from the restaurant being back there in a substantial way.
Are there former staff that would want to come back on board?
Yeah.
That believe in you again and see what happened?
Yeah. A couple of really key ones, too. That's like, oh, that'd be amazing.
Yeah. And what about... is there a world where you could start smaller and just do a one lucky duck somewhere? you know, like a pop-up of something where you start and people see who you are again? Or no, you want to just, you want to be in that restaurant?
I think that location really makes the most sense. You know, I'm also kind of spread very thin right now. It's just like this whole, my whole world is just me. I don't have a PR. I don't have an agent. I don't have publicity. I don't have help with my social media. I don't have, you know, it's just me.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, to kind of to open a small little One Lucky Duck is a lot of work
right,
in itself.
Of course. Yeah. So if you're going to invest in something, you want to do it the right way. You just want to do the big thing.
Yeah, I think it should be. I think it should be the big thing. I think it should be in that space. And I think it has only more potential than it did in the past when all these people were coming to me about expanding all over the world and taking the brand, you know, internationally and opening here, opening there. I think it has all that potential and more now than it did before. But again, it's I'm protective of it in that I don't want it to be something that's kind of exploited. I mean, I had somebody come along with very deep pockets, but they wanted me to be in a reality show. They wanted to turn it into a reality show. And I was like, yeah, it's not that vibe.
Right. No, I totally understand.
Yeah. And for something to be big and meaningful and impactful and last and not become another one of those brands that kind of gets big for a while and then it deteriorates because, you know, it expands too quickly and then the integrity is compromised and then it just kind of ends up failing or fizzling out. I think this is something that should never fizzle out. You know, I would want it to outlast me.
Of course. Is there a point where you give up on this though and you change lanes and you move somewhere else or you start something else or you get into something else? Or is this what you are focused on and this is what you are going to do?
Well, I mean, I have that very like, I feel like I have to have that sense of detachment, right? Where you can't get so attached to some one thing. So I'm kind of very open to whatever happens. I mean, I want to write another book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am working on this other docuseries. I think I can write another book and do the restaurant, but either way, I want to write another book.
Sure.
But also it's hard to, it's hard to move forward when I'm in this sort of place of constantly trying to catch up and stressing out about like, how am I going to pay my rent next month? And can I get another credit card? And like, what am I going to do? And, you know, it's hard also. I mean, I think that's not people's impression of me. They sort of see me in an apartment in Manhattan and assume that like, things are very different than they are.
Right.
So.
Isn't that the misunderstanding of social media, though? Everyone thinks that everyone's lives are so great when they really have nothing to do with what they're seeing.
Right, exactly. And I'm always, you know, I try to stay very grounded and grateful, too, because, I mean, there's atrocities happening all over the world and, like, people starving and a bunch of fucked up shit happening. And, you know, credit card debt is just numbers and, you know, I have food to eat and I have friends that care about me and people that are helpful and I have a lot of opportunity. So, you know, I stay grounded and feeling like super grateful that, you know, I'm healthy and things are fine. I'm in a home. I'm surrounded by books and, you know, and I have this sort of sense of determination that things will work out. And I think maybe some of the things that happened recently were because they weren't meant to work out with, for example, Jeffrey.
Right.
It wasn't meant to work out where he's involved in the business and having a piece of it,
right,
of this very special business.
Right. And I think that's a testament to timing is very important and it's everything.
Yeah.
So you may have this dream and it may not be that it's the wrong dream. It just may take some time to find the right partners and the right everything coming together at once. And it's good it didn't happen in the wrong way yet.
Yeah. I mean, when something happened recently where it was like a holy shit, I can't believe this happened moment, it felt simultaneously like terrifying because it sort of was this risk of, oh my God, am I losing this space again?
Yeah.
But I had this sense inside of, or This is going to be one of those things where down the road I look back and go, okay, it was actually good that that happened,
right,
because it wasn't meant to happen that way. It was meant to happen another way.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, it's kind of terrifying being in that limbo space.
Right.
And so, as I said, it's hard to know what to do when you don't have the money to hire attorneys and kind of be aggressive in a legal sense. So, but, you know, in all these situations, at least I have sort of the facts and the truth on my side.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of over time telling the story of what happened. And it'll, you know, when I write another memoir, which I think one way or another I will, I really want to, I already have an outline, mm-hmm. and I have more valuable, I think, stories to tell and experience that I think is useful for people. So I'll tell these stories in the next memoir too.
Good. I mean, I know we could talk all day and I have a million questions, but before we end, I do want to just ask you, because everybody will want to know, what happened to Anthony? What happened to Mr. Fox? Where the hell is
he? Oh, well, good question. I mean, I ended up participating in a different show. I didn't want to participate initially because I just didn't, you know, I didn't really understand what they were doing and I wasn't really in control. But do you know who Elizabeth Chambers is?
Yes.
Okay. So she did a show. It's on Discovery/Max, HBO Max. You can watch it there. And I think it was just made available internationally. But she created a show called, the title of the show is Toxic. And each episode is a story about some fucked up shit. And I'm actually, when I watched all the other episodes, so there are two episodes about Mr. Fox and I'm in them. Mm-hmm. And kind of, it's where he is now. And it's kind of fascinating. But even the episodes before mine tell stories of really horrific stuff. And I'm glad that the show was made and I'm glad that people are watching it because, you know, having had that kind of crazy shit happen to me, what happens when that stuff happens to you and maybe you don't have a show made about you or, you know, it's not high profile or written about or whatever, people, it's like the shit that happens is so messed up that when somebody tries to go to the police for help or talk to a doctor or tell your family members, it almost makes you sound like you're the crazy one.
Yeah.
Because the story is so crazy and people can't comprehend
right.
that somebody can be so diabolical or so twisted or so irrational.
Right.
But this stuff happens. So, there's four stories before the one that highlights Mr. Fox of four other women who've had really messed up stuff happen to them. And those are all involve a lot of violence too. They're really harrowing. And then there's two episodes about Mr. Fox and I'm in them because Elizabeth is basically hunting him down. And to her credit, I mean, goes to great lengths to find him because, you know, they want to know who's he been after, what's he been up to. And I already knew some of what he'd been up to because, for example, he lived in these people's house during COVID. And then I think what happened is the Bad Vegan trailer came out and they saw it and realized who he was. He left. And somebody who lived in that household reached out to me. And so I'd been in touch with them. So I was aware of some of what had happened.
And did he do something fucked up with them?
Yeah, he did fucked up shit with them and
lied to them.
And yeah, of course. I mean, it's really gross stuff. And
do you think he follows you on Instagram under a fake name?
I don't know. Once in a while, like somebody will pop up like on Twitter, X. I don't even like and I mean, I don't post there that much, but I don't know. Maybe out of curiosity, he looks every once in a while. I have no idea, but I don't know if he saw that. Anyway, but spoiler alert, she does find him.
Does she get him to talk on camera?
He does talk on camera, but reluctantly. But yeah,
from her, like, trying to talk through a door, or he, like, sits down with her?
He doesn't sit down with her.
Okay.
But she, I mean, my heart was pounding. I mean, when she told me about it, I was like,
I've
told her, like, Elizabeth Chambers has balls of steel.
Oh, I've got to go see this.
She runs after him. And, you know, I mean, he's a big dude.
Oh,
my God, he is enormous. Enormous. And he's got the stash. I didn't even notice it the first time I watched it because it's kind of blurry. What happened is they were like –
staking
the
him
batteries
out.
Run out on their cameras because they're waiting for him all day, but they get it all on iPhone footage.
Oh, okay.
And so you have the audio and some video of him, but yeah, you know how there's like this trend where all these dudes have mustaches.
Right, yeah.
So yeah, he has a
wait, so
mustache.
Where is he living?
So they found him in Arizona.
Okay.
And he was with a woman.
Oh.
And I hope that somehow that woman has gotten away from him as a result of it.
Oh my gosh.
I really hope. But I mean, I think he's just, unless.
Well, there's just no way he could get away with any credibility after this docuseries of Bad Vegan coming out, plus your book. I mean, I'm shocked that he hasn't tried to talk, because with his kind of narcissism, you would think he would want to be like, let me tell you what really happened, because Sarma's out of her mind. You know, like, I'm shocked that that side of the story hasn't come out.
Yeah. I mean, there's all variety of, you know, I wouldn't call him a narcissist. He's more of a sociopath.
Right.
But, you know, has a lot of those same characteristics. There are people out there who, you know, get busted for something and then, you know, astonishingly, they'll keep coming out there and talking about it, and they'll come up with some excuse, and they'll kind of keep putting themselves out in the public eye because they can't help it. They just want the attention.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I'm thinking of somebody specific. It was a female, not a male. But but I don't think he's like that. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
ABC tried to get him to go after Bad Vegan. ABC tried to get him to go on a show, and he actually spoke to them. But I don't think he's the type to want to expose himself more at all. I don't think there's a certain type of, again, like a narcissist, where they just want attention.
Well, he also probably knew he had you, right? He could manipulate you. He could eventually get you to do what he wanted. But then when he has a whole audience watching that, I think it's different. I mean,
yeah, for him to do what he does now, he does not want to be known.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to have a fake name. He did legally change his name to Anthony Knight.
Okay.
He married somebody, took that person's name.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I'm sure if he could, you know, get a facelift, he would, something, right, so he's not recognizable.
Right.
So he's trying to,
like,
go
in
under.
That movie Face Off. Have you ever seen that, where they change faces?
Was that John Travolta?
Yeah. Such a good movie. Did he change
and
faces
Nick Cage
with somebody else? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure if he could do that, he would.
Right.
You know, maybe that's why he had the mustache. Maybe, yeah. So if he could go under the radar, I'm sure he would. So I don't think he would come out and speak out.
I
don't think that's his jam.
Okay. Well, I don't know. It'd be interesting. I might have to try and track him down one day and ask him some questions myself. I love shit like that.
Amazing, but I don't think.
Okay, just
answer.
A few rapid fire questions, because I know we're really over time here. One is, what is one misconception about you that you are dying to correct?
Oh God. I don't. I mean, I think the cliche one is that I didn't eat the pizza, but that's sort of cliche. I mean, I think it's
not cliche.
I think my book does it, but it's just, you know, I'm not crazy. I'm not greedy. You know, my intentions were the exact opposite of what happened. You know, I think Bad Vegan could allow people to think that, like, I was greedy and I wanted this money that he pretended to have, and so that's why I went along with it and screw my employees. Like, it wasn't like that at all. You know, I think I just deeply want to help people understand how this can happen on behalf of all the other people that this happens to.
Right. What's one line from the book that means the most to you?
It took getting arrested to set me free. That's a line in the book.
Love that. What would you tell your former self the day you met Anthony, if you could?
Run. I mean, yeah, just run. I mean, I think the lesson there is to pay attention to your intuition.
Mm-hmm.
Also the danger of meeting people online, which I think is hugely important for people to understand now. I mean, you can really get attached to somebody before you've even met them, and you can get manipulated
before you have any references on who they even are. You're absolutely
and
right.
I think meeting somebody in person is so important, because you get, you know, I mean, you can still get manipulated and duped, but you also can get a vibe that something's off.
Yeah. But you got to remember to look for those red flags, because I think when you're in that mode, you just let those go and you just think, oh,
yeah. And there's also a huge danger in anybody who's trying to move really fast, you know?
Yeah.
Like there's no reason not to take something slow.
Right.
If somebody's moving really fast and kind of bombarding you with positivity, you know, they call it love bombing is sort of the classic phrase. And, you know, when people get pulled into cults or these types of relationships, there's like the love bombing phase where they're sort of showering you with whatever it is that you kind of deeply want. In my case was a lot of affirmation.
Right, right. Last thing, is there anything in the book you hope people do not overlook?
Do not overlook. I don't know. I mean, this is sort of random. It's not that they would overlook it, but I mean, I was a little bit worried about, you know, in all of the communications I included, I'm pretty sarcastic and I talk back at him a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, somebody reading the book said, you know, that might make it seem like I had more awareness of what was going on than, but I, you know, that part to me is kind of perplexing and I think fascinating. So, you know, I mean, I'm very honest. I include a lot of stuff, even when I think it might make me look questionable. Mm-hmm. And some of it I include because it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Like when, you know, these very tense moments and then I'll kind of come back at him and, you know, make fun of him or say something sarcastic. But that was just kind of my way of coping to try to get through it. So I just hope people realize that, you know, I just did everything I could to, you know, be as honest as I could, even if it, you know, even if it's embarrassing or makes me look bad in some ways.
Right. For me as a reader, I just thought, and I know at the end you talk about how Alec Baldwin had once said there's something fragile about her or something. And whether or not you're a victim, you know, you didn't want to kind of address. And it's sort of like what I don't want people to overlook is that you were very strong as a person. You created this concept and this business, of course, with Matthew, but like this was your thing. This was what you were known for. You were the face of it. You created everything. You were so strong in that. But through all of it, you were very alone. And even through your writing, you seem very alone, you know, and all the places you had to go and things you had to do and things you had to go through. You had to lie to people and you had a wall up and you were very alone. Being alone doesn't necessarily make you a victim. It doesn't make you fragile. But it makes you someone who has to work it all out in your own head. And sometimes that's really hard. You don't have anyone to bang it off of or check things
and
with.
And it's deliberate on their part. I mean, it's why cults end up isolating people from the outside world. And in these culty relationships, they isolate you. They sort of get you to cut ties and they push other people in your life away.
Yeah.
And so being, you know, wired the way that I am and being kind of an introvert and being somebody that sort of, you know, doesn't have like a whole gaggle of friends around me all the time, it's easy to isolate me. And then what happens is you get into this messed up situation where you can't talk to anybody about it.
Yeah.
So it was extremely isolating.
Yeah. And then I just think my takeaway for you is that I hope that you find that fullness, you know, whether it's from getting a dog, from getting a boyfriend, from just reading a good book, or from being able to reopen your restaurant. And I truly hope that happens for you. I truly, you know, I hope in any way, shape, or form I ever come across something that I know that I can send your way. I mean, I really see that that is what you are meant to do. I know that that is your dream. And I think that you deserve a second chance. Third, fourth, fifth, whatever it is. But
Thank you.
I do think that you deserve it and I hope you get it. And
no,
this book
is
amazing.
That.
Everyone should read it. Tell people where they can get it.
It's on Amazon. It is, you can, if you're one of those people that doesn't want to buy things from Amazon, you can buy it direct from the printer at the same price, which is, I have a link on, so I have a website for the book where I also posted a bunch of pictures by chapter. I'm actually still putting them up.
That's so cool.
But yeah, I mean, I have so many photographs and when I'm reading a memoir, I'm always like Googling or looking at pictures. So I put them all on a website, which is just the title of the book, thegirlwiththeducktattoo.com.
Right.
So on that website, in my Instagram links, there's a link to, you know, Amazon worldwide. You can buy it direct from the printer for the same price, which is better for me. You can get a signed copy from me that I'll mail to you. That's all on the website. And
what's your Instagram if people want to DM
My Instagram
you
is my full name, Sarma Melangailis. If I could just, my Twitter handle is just Sarma. I wish I could have that for Instagram too and just go by Sarma. It's a lot easier. But I thought a lot about it. And like, if I won the lottery, would I still want to reopen that business and go through all that in that same location? And yeah, I would, because it's not about me. It's about that place existing again. And I think for me, it's really matters that whatever I do, that I'm useful, you know?
Right.
So it's really heartwarming to me that people not only are entertained by the book and they really enjoyed reading it, but that they find it, it's especially meaningful to that people find it helpful and useful. And I think really meaningful is, I know a lot of people who've been through something similar and their families don't understand, people in their lives don't understand, how could that happen? And so, you know, here's something where they can have their family read it or somebody and have that person go, oh, like now I understand what you went through.
Right.
So I hope it's really useful in that way too. And it just matters to me to be useful.
Right. The Girl with the Duck Tattoo, please go get it. It's really good. Sarma, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
I hope the next time I
love
have you on, it's like to talk about you opening
the docuseries or the reopening. Who knows?
Exactly. All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time. Understood.